You're listening to the Cerberus Podcast with a K, available on Cerberus.com, iTunes, Stitch.com, and Audio Boo.
Oh, ladies and gentlemen, it's a podcast with Christian Corley, James McLean, and Brian Terranova. Now, listen, normally, and guys, you'll know this because I emailed you about it, we have a list of things that we're going to talk about, but there's some things that have happened today.
Yeah.
So they've been added to what we were going to talk about. Okay, so as well as what we were going to talk about, chaps, we're also going to talk about the new episodes. titles that have been released today.
Oh, right, okay.
And we may find ourselves talking about things that previously we were unable to talk about.
Birds and the bees. About time. I've been waiting to talk about that.
I'm not listening. La, la,
la. Typical American.
Oh, dear. Okay, so, well, today is Monday. We're recording this on Monday afternoon. And we are now the recipients of... I'm going to say us. I mean, every Doctor Who fan knows what the episodes are called for the new series and knows who wrote them. That's all 12 episodes of the next run of Doctor Who, which commences this coming Saturday. So, I'm going to read through them, and I want you both to raise your eyebrows and make noises when appropriate, when something surprising happens, okay? Episode 1 is Deep Breath by Stephen Moffat. Episode 2 is Into the Dark by Phil Ford and Stephen Moffat. Episode 3 and Stephen Moffat.
You said Into the what?
Dark.
Oh, well, I was going to say.
Into the Dark? Begging
you said Dark. Dark. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I meant Dalek. Into the Dark by Phil Ford.
That sounds suggestive.
And Stephen Moffat. Episode 3 is Robot of Sherwood. That's Robot of Sherwood, not Robots, by Mark Gatiss. Episode 4 is Listen by Stephen Moffat.
No surprise.
Which he doesn't do.
Episode
Listen.
5.
Listen, blink, look, talk, walk, think.
Episode 5 is Time Heist by Stephen Thompson and Stephen Moffat. Episode 6 is The Caretaker by Gareth Roberts and Stephen Moffat. Uh-huh. Episode 7 is Kill the Moon by the hitherto unknown Doctor Who writer Peter Harness. That may not be a real name. It may
right.
be. Mummy on the Orient Express is episode 8 by Jamie Matheson, who also... Has he done a Doctor Who or not? I don't recall him doing a Doctor Who previously.
Not familiar name.
No. Episode 9 is Flatline by Jamie Matheson. Episode 10 is In the Forest of the Night by Frank Cottrell Boyce, which is kind of the big name for this series. And episodes 11 and 12 are Dark Water and Death in Heaven by Stephen Moffat. Did anything pop up there when I was reading those names out? Did raise eyebrows or anything?
Two things popped up for me based on previous knowledge as well. Mm-hmm. Is this what we're talking about? Mm. Is this what we're allowed to talk about?
We're going to go into it a little bit, yeah.
Yes, the inclusion suddenly of Stephen Moffat on all external writers, bar one, interestingly.
Well, a couple. There's Mark Gatiss, and there's this there's Frank Cottrell Boyce, and
yes, that's what I was thinking about.
And Jamie Matheson, yeah. But Gareth Roberts, Stephen Thompson, and Phil Ford, who have all written Doctor Who previously, have been teamed up with Stephen Moffat.
Yep.
Mm.
We're going to put this as delicately as possible. We heard a few weeks ago that there was some consternation within Doctor Who writer circles that Stephen Moffat's name was being added to certain credits. And here we find that Stephen Moffat's name has been added to certain credits that he has had a hand in doing additional work on, presumably his job on. In much the way Stephen's Moffat's predecessor, Russell T. Davies, did work in his role as in his capacity as executive producer and showrunner and making sure everything fit nicely and worked correctly, which is kind of what he was paid to do. Now, we're not going too much into that this side of things of like what we've heard. But if, and it's a big if, Stephen Moffat has done additional work on these things, on these episodes, firstly, do you think he should be getting a credit? And secondly, isn't this the sort of thing he should have been doing from day one?
Yeah, no, that's what I kind of feel. It's either something which is established as part of the production's writing hierarchy or you know, credits, should I say, or it's not. And I think I tend to feel, I mean, I've never actually looked into this, and I really should, but I got the impression that the Russell D. Davis sort of established the role of showrunner was actually as a chief script editor as well, or certainly carrying an editorial veto, editorial rights. So if you're a script editor, if that's really what you're doing, which is what I got the impression Davis was doing, okay, he was a heavy script editor, then that isn't really, I don't know. I'm not quite sure. It depends on what Stephen's done to these, but if he's just done what Russell's been doing, what he's been doing through the series, no, I don't think he should get a co-writing. I would have thought it opens a door for, well, this has sort of happened in the States. I was talking to someone the other day with Aaron Sorkin from The West Wing, who used to do something similar, or maybe, depending on what Stephen Moffat does, where he would do the writer's meeting, you know, the team writer's table. And then he would sort of ask for ideas, apparently, and suggestions, and then he would sort of pull them together, and then he would take the writing credit. But there was the question of how much was he sourcing from other writers to take the credit on the writing. And again, I don't know. I don't know. The situation was just told to me as an example of someone who... It's hard, isn't it? Because you don't want to say it's unethical, but it approaches writing and crediting in a different way to what a lot of people would expect.
I just want to clarify, Peter Harness is a real writer. He's not a nom de plume. He's not a bland pseudonym or anything like that. He wrote the Frankie Howard, Rather You Than Me TV movie that David Walliams was in.
Oh, right.
He also wrote three episodes of Wallander in 2012, and he's done a few other bits and bobs.
Cool. You learn something new every day.
Yeah.
But that's how I feel anyway. I feel, yes, it's unusual, it's unorthodox. I'm not quite sure it's very fair, though, on the established expectations of what a writer puts into.
Brian?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, just based, again, like what we had talked about prior, if that there was maybe a little bit of a struggle going with this, I do feel, I don't know, it can be a tad unfair to the particular writers if they... poured their heart and soul in this, and he wants a writing credit on it, having not done much, you know. But if it's like what Russell claims to have done in his book, where he rewrote, you know, 50 to 90% of scripts, then I guess at the same time it's understandable. But I look at somebody like Phil Ford, and he's co-written with Russell T. Davis before, and that was co-writing. It was announced that they were going to be collaboratively writing. So I wonder if there's anything similar here going on, and certain
but
reports
then,
aren't, you know, exactly kosher, I guess. But what's that?
But then, say, Water of Mars, which was, as I recall, did he ever co-write on that, or did he
Phil
Ford? It was for Davis. Yeah. It was actually written as a co-writer. I know he did co-write, Davis did. I didn't know if he could remember if he established a credit on it or not.
Yeah, right, yes, okay. There is a credit on it. But I think the difference is with Phil Ford is that Mark Gatiss has had, we know Mark Gatiss, we know what he's done. But Phil Ford has run his own show, Sarah Jane Adventures.
Mm-hmm.
So it's quite strange that he should be working on a co-credit.
Well, I think possibly the thing which is getting us a bit is the what we were told, that there was frustration within the team or within the production, which sort of suggests that what's going on is a little unorthodox. I think if we didn't have that, we would probably just say, well, we don't know how much Stephen has written on that. He might have actually been really hands on and co-written. But I think the fact that we've heard that people aren't happy with it seems to suggest that boundaries have shifted, whether it's right or wrong, and I think that's why we as our team are a little negative about it, just in case people sort of say, well, how can you say that to the Moff, he's probably done great work on it. It's like, well, you know.
No, you're absolutely right, James. And we're only saying what we've heard. We're not by any means we're not saying that what we heard was true, but it is very interesting that it should chime in this particular way.
It also does make me wonder, too, when these episodes air, if there's any kind of, like, typical Moff issues with a script. And, you know, forgive me for saying that, but we all know that there are typical Moff issues in scripts. You know, who then would take the blame? You know, obviously
there's only one
fitting
person.
That it's him. Well,
he's,
you know,
he's at the top of the tree, isn't he?
That's a really interesting point, because I always used to find that with people used to dislike Davis's era, because Davis was so, I'm going to use a very negative word, he was so invasive in the scripts, and possibly, in my opinion, in quite a positive way. But because he was so involved in rewrites, you could feel his influence over every story.
Yeah.
Well, with Moffat's era, you didn't always quite feel that. I always got the feeling that a lot of the time he stood back for whatever reason, whether he was busy or because he wanted to respect their distance, I don't know. So if this season feels different and feels, as Brian says, more Moffat all the way across the board, that would be interesting to see whether we feel that's the case, or does it feel the same as before, just with his credit on more?
Or will it feel different this time?
Mm. Yeah, like how many did he already previously overwrite or rewrite or supposedly co-write but not get a credit? And maybe the frustration on his end is, I work hard, I want this credit now. So maybe we won't notice a difference whatsoever, or maybe in this season, for whatever reason, things took a different turn. Besides, we also know, you know, with Capaldi being there, maybe there were certain things, especially the way he already said no hanky-panky in the TARDIS, no flirting. He had a very definitive vision. Maybe he's on set, you know, saying this doesn't work, that doesn't work, and maybe Stephen Moffat is changing things during that process, and maybe he's getting the credits there because it's hands-on, you know, changes of the moment.
But then, you know, I mean, this is a problem, isn't it, with film and television, is it? Because it's a collab, and it's something that which scholars will always debate, is who has creative rights, because everything is so intermixed. I mean, as soon as you've got a writer, you know, in films, then you might have a screenwriter, and then also you've got the director who can get involved, and then you've got studios who can push changes and even networks. You know, how far do you go with splitting credits? To a certain degree, do you have to stand back and say, yeah, I may have written on this, but the core idea and the core person who's written this is X person. And if I have not been sort of sitting with him at the genesis of this story and fleshing out the script, am I actually a writer? Do I have to sort of step back and say, okay, hands up, I have done a lot of this, but it's a production. Everything does. There is a certain cross-pollination just by being a production. I mean, you know that yourself, Brian, from doing independent stuff. And,
yeah, absolutely.
Christian studying it, you know, and we're studying it. So we all know that. It's so collaborative.
Mm.
How far do you cross those boundaries, those lines?
Well, and, you know, I will say this, too, that the most recent episode of my series, Legacy, that we had just done, I have actually given a co-writing credit to one of the actors in our film, because he talked out a bunch of ideas with me, and I ended up using some of them, and I felt personally it was right. You know what? You should get a co-credit on here, because there's this scene that you really heavily contributed to. So how do we know that these other writers aren't saying the same thing? Or, I mean, the fact that it's Steven constantly on all of them, it seems very unlikely that all of those writers are suggesting that, and more so him suggesting it. But it does happen. I mean, I felt that those changes were there, and I didn't feel right just having my name on as a writer when somebody else contributed to those facts. So to me, it was more of a moral thing. I just felt it was necessary. I felt it was right. With Moffat, though, I mean, it could be the reverse. You know, he contributed. He feels, yes, it's also morally right, but more so that he tacks his name onto somebody else's work rather than them offering the reverse.
Well, that's what I used to do when I was in the band as well. I used to write everything lyrically, and I'd write the music. But when we did the single, it came out, we made sure I said it was a band thing, because in the end, you still got people putting their own bass lines to it, or the, you know, the drum patterns. You know, you're letting people get involved and fluidly be creative. You may have scored the roots, but, you know, do you then take credit for all the bits that the professionals have done as well? You know, the other professionals. So it is a difficult one. I think the only other interesting point here is that if it is unusual, if it is unorthodox, does it create a precedent? If he isn't involved at the roots, and he is a showrunner who has felt that his influence over scripts requires a credit, will that change? I mean, we don't have showrunners particularly in the BBC, or in UK television. It's an unusual role. It's a US role. But if they do become more proliferate, will that change how, you know, will writers' unions get involved? I don't know. It could be interesting.
We'll have to see how it pans out. Before we move on to the next item, I just want to say that a car has just driven past, and the last three letters on the number plate were O, H, and W.
Huh.
So if you were driving along in front of that car and you looked in your mirror, you'd say, who? There you go. So anyway, more back to the point. Third unreleased Doctor Who episode leaks online.
Really?
Yeah, so Robot of Sherwood is now online in its monochrome rough cut with the Marcelo Camacho watermark on it, and BBC Worldwide watermark. Now, although I'm going to just go into an article that Alex is currently writing as we're recording on this. Although the BBC was quick to plug the leak in the good ship Camargo, it appeared the damage had already been done, and within hours the internet was awash with early episode reviews and high profile spoilers. At first it seemed that the only video felt to have been pirated was the season opener Deep Breath, as nobody appeared to have seen or heard anything pertaining to the other episodes. However, the situation was turned on its head when, out of the blue, Series 8's second episode, Into the Dalek, mysteriously appeared on Pirate Bay. And now this week, we have Robot of Sherwood doing the rounds in the Doctor Who underbelly. The more this situation develops, I can't help but think of Judi Dench in the 2012 James Bond spectacular Skyfall and her reaction when the identities of government super agents were uploaded onto YouTube, along with the chilling message, five more every week. Think on your sins. Is someone releasing these episodes periodically for a reason? Asks Alex. We're not going to go into that. But, it does make you wonder, doesn't it, dear listener? It does make you wonder. There is no point downloading these, though, now, is there really? It starts on Saturday. People are going to download
Saturday,
it.
Yeah. Yeah.
It starts Saturday, so you just enjoy it with everyone else now, can't you? If you couldn't get it to New York or Mexico or London or Cardiff or Seoul or Sydney or the one that's coming up in Rio, I think that's today or tomorrow, just wait till it's on the telly. There's no need to be downloading these now, is there?
Well, I mean, I think the problem is that fandom is horrendously territorial, isn't it? I mean, if anyone's gone to a convention, and I am sure that Brian will attest to this, you'll get the person who will stand up and say, you know, next series, we all know that that Jane is going to become pregnant with the son of so-and-so. What do you think about that? Will be a question to an actor or to a writer, which is basically saying, hey, I know what's happening in the future. I want to let everyone know that I know more about this show than you do because I know stuff in the future. Mm. Is there a bit of that here? There's a sort
it's
of
bragging
a
rights.
Yes, and people are getting... They have to see it first.
Yeah.
Seeing it for them.
Exactly. Yeah. It's the bragging rights. They just want to be special. They want it to be known that they're special because nobody is asking them how special they are. So they have to put it out there and say how special they are, which they're not special. They're just spoilers.
But if that doesn't work, Brian, they get their lightsaber out, don't they?
Yes, they do. And they ask questions about Star Wars at a Doctor Who convention.
Yeah.
Peter Davison, what's your favorite Star Wars film? No, but like we talked about before, I admit that I have interest in seeing these early working copies of the episodes as a filmmaker. They interest me to see how these things were done and how they were completed, but I have no interest in seeing them first. It's more so watch the episode first as it's finished and then go back and check out how these things were done, which is one of the best things about DVD special features or even Doctor Who Confidential, where they used to show you these kinds of things. Mm. You know, it's maybe not necessary to watch an entire episode of it, but I do admit that there's some interest for me in watching these things, but to see them beforehand just seems a waste. It seems
if you were doing a hard, like James, you're going to be doing a film studies.
Yeah.
Is it a degree or is it a master's?
Masters.
Masters, right. So if you were doing a hardcore reading on a particular scene, it would be massively beneficial to watch the original as a broadcast and then see the rough cut version of it, wouldn't it?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Definitely. Definitely.
But carry on, Brian.
Yeah.
No, I was just saying, it's a shame that they're leaked. It's a shame that it's illegal because it would be something interesting to check out. But I don't think it's something that people should be checking out first, especially since, you know, some people can actually be watching these and giving some awful reviews based on, say, the effects,
which are
unfinished. Like, give it a chance. Give it a chance on the actual show. But, you know, there's no reason. I mean, what are you going to do? You're going to watch yourself sing.
I don't think there's any music in
there. No, there's no music. No, it's these are rough cut. These are work prints. They're not I think what really gets me angry about it, as being someone who has been in creative circles all my life, and you know, all of us have in some degree, you know, work in creative circles, is that, you know, it's very important that, you know, what you want to show off, what you want to showcase is your final product. You don't want people to see the bits around the edges. You don't want them to see the dirty marks and the, you know, the poor sketches or the screwed up writings or the bad edits, or you want them to see what you've been aiming to achieve. And while I agree with Christian from an academic point of view, work prints and the like are very, you know, are very fascinating. Like anything, if they don't belong to you, you should only see them if the people who own them have given the authorization and are comfortable with releasing that data. And if they want money for it, that's their choice because it's their product. It's not yours. So it irritates me on so many levels. It's such an infringement on intellectual property. It's an infringement on creative property. And I think it's very hurtful for those who are trying to create a final finishing product, because it does damage it. You know, I've heard someone say they've seen the third episode. It's hard because it's in black and white, and it's not very good to really see. But that's because there can be such a difference between, say, even just a scored scene and a non-scored scene. You know, a shot which hasn't gone through filters in post, and one that has. It's a totally different art form, and you're ruining that. The experience of that end shot, because you're seeing it the wrong way around. Work prints should be watched after you've seen the finished product, if you're academic. That's how it should really be. You should see the final thing and then see the work print to compare, not the other way around. So yeah, it's
annoying. And if these things don't have music, or even if they have placeholder music or something, that can seriously affect a scene. The music dictates the emotion you're supposed to feel or the intensity of the scene. So if you're feeling a scene isn't working because there's no music, or maybe there's some odd placeholder music there, you can't judge that. You know, like it's more interesting, like you said, go to it after the fact, if they make it commercially after the fact, and see what was there, what they were working with, and try to figure out where their brain was when they were editing that scene to either no music or placeholder music. Yeah. It's far more interesting that way.
Yeah, I totally agree. But as we say, that's not why people are doing it. They're not doing it for work print comparisons. They're doing it for territorialness or just something out of a status, or just because they're just not being very thoughtful and a little self-focused. It's a shame. And if you're one of those guys out there, sorry, mate, but you really shouldn't have.
Have a word with yourself.
Exactly. Because I think this is going to happen more probably as the internet becomes more prolific with its media content and video content.
Yeah.
A certain amount of control should be there to respect the creators, personally, but there you go. There's only one person listening to this, so what's the point?
Yes. Hello, listener. Should we move on to another topic then?
Why not?
It's usually what we do, isn't it?
I did ask the oddities to come today. But they were busy being...
smeared with Philadelphia?
Consumed somewhere. They're too small for Philadelphia.
Oh, are they? All right.
That's so crass. That's like some northerner trying to be rich and classy. And the reason I say that is I saw an advert yesterday and I was laughing at it. I'm trying to think what the advert was for, but it was still carrying on that same notion that it's very funny to have someone with a thick northern accent in a classy setting, because northerners just can't be classy. Mm. There's still that joke. I remember 20 years ago, Boddington's Beer was doing that gag. You know, and they're still doing it, that if you're from the north, you can't be classy, and there's the joke.
Well, you know, I've got to take issue with that, because I think that the doyen of the media, Cheryl Cole or whatever her name is now, has proved that northerners can be classy with that huge tattoo on her ass. So forget your rum talk about northerners not being classy.
Exactly.
Do you know, I was watching the Doctor Who movies again with Peter Cushing.
Okay.
And I got to the one with Bernard Cribbins. And now, I don't know what his accent is. I'm not 100% up on all that, but I know it's not really a northern accent. But I also know it's not received pronunciation. And I thought it was rather cool that in that film, you know, he got away with being himself during a time when really they kind of just wanted you to have a very specific accent. And
it's
I like that.
True.
Well, he was a good character actor, wasn't he? Or isn't he? Bernard Cribbins. And, you know, he does a show on the that the twins watch called Old Jack's Boat, which I think I mentioned on the podcast before because Russell T. Davies has done a few episodes. The Cribster's in it. Don Gile's in it, who was Donna's husband in The Runaway Bride. Who else is in it? Oh, Martha's in it as well. Finn Magaman's in it as well. But it's set in North Yorkshire, in a town called Staithes. But Bernard Cribbins is from Lancashire. He's from Oldham, which is in the north. He's had a few accents in his time, quite clearly. But yeah. Is there some way we could possibly mention Bernard Cribbins in every podcast in the future? Do you think?
Right.
I love talking about Bernard Cribbins. I love that Fawlty Towers episode he's in. Where Basil Fawlty mistakes him for a hotel inspector and then they try to kill each other.
Bless him.
Yeah. Okay. How did we get onto Bernard Cribbins? Oh, you were watching the Doctor Who movies, the Dalek movies.
Yes, yeah. I was.
You talk about accents, wasn't it? Accents. All about accents.
Yeah. All about accents. Okay. Did we talk then about, because you've thrown me with the talk of your your little snacks and have we done?
Well, I was just going to say, my butler had just brought me what he called a yellow sherbet. I think he was trying to emulate Austin Powers, who was obviously trying to emulate his class, but
yeah.
He couldn't do it very well. But I think I will leave it to the end. I think it might just they're very fruity, lemon sherbets. They might. I just don't think they fit into our format.
Okay.
So no, be gone. Right. No, take it away. Take it away.
What's your butler called, by the way?
Take it away, or I take your children. Yeah, now he's gone.
Such an odd name, that.
It is,
isn't it? You can't believe how frustrating it was. It was so frustrating when we actually had to get a far larger application form to fit that name.
Jenna Coleman is reported to be leaving Doctor Who with the Christmas episode, reportedly. Being
she trying to replace James's butler?
I doubt it.
Oh, could she replace my butler? I have to say, and I'll only say it to you two because there's only the listener listening, and yeah. That's the butler.
Yeah.
I think I've got a bit of a crush on Jenna. I've not had a crush on TV stars since I was like sort of 16. Isn't that crazy? Weird.
Yeah.
But anyway, yes, my creepy crushes aside, yeah, she sounds like she's leaving, don't it?
Yeah, I mean, last week we did ask the question, is she leaving because she's got a social network account now? Which is a little...
You hadn't.
No, I didn't. I didn't wish I had. I didn't write it. Danny wrote it.
Well, given the comments that came through.
Oh, yeah, well, you know, people are more than welcome to leave comments on Casterbus because we have a comments form for them to leave their comments upon. And, you know, it's freedom of speech about Doctor Who. You know, when you're getting your Fourth Amendment rights trampled on, why not use your freedom of speech to talk about a TV show? That's what I say.
Good on you.
Yeah. A little bit of political satire there for Brian's benefit.
Oh, thanks.
That's okay. but, you know, it's a little bit of a spurious thing to hang upon the old, she's leaving, she's got a social network, it must be happening. But now the Mirror are saying that she's reported to be leaving, and they cite a BBC source, who's another person with an odd name, who says, it's important to keep the series moving and fast-paced, and the time is just starting to feel right, and the feeling is that it could be a perfect Christmas storyline. The conversations about Jenna's exit have started, and a plan is in place which is being ironed out. By the time she leaves, she will be one of the longest-standing companions ever. That's not strictly true, but she has kind of got a long gap between her first and last episodes, hasn't she? Which is perhaps what they're getting at there. If she, indeed Christmas will be her last episode. She has been absolutely brilliant in the role, but everyone agrees it is a part that should change after a period. Full stop.
It's very interestingly phrased if you take any of it as being
specifically credible. That's why I think it is real, because it is a very oddly phrased sentence.
Because, I mean, what I find a little disturbing about it is that there's almost a suggestion there that maybe this wasn't an actress choice. If you read into which I think would be very disappointing if that is the case. And I think this could bring to the topic of, is it good, you know, transitional companions for doctors? Should the companions go reasonably soon. Is there an argument that that's a good way, that they should transition for the Doctor and then they leave and the Doctor starts a new era? Is that a thing, do you think, or is that?
I don't know. Well, do you know what?
Because that's obviously what they're almost suggesting. That's what I mean. They're suggesting a new era. Get rid of all the old.
Get rid of the old.
And I'm not sure I totally agree with that. If the dynamic changes, why not allow a companion to carry on if they're enjoying the role?
Yeah. No, I agree. I think it's interesting. How many episodes? She's only done half a series with Matt Smith, hasn't she? And then she's done two specials. Which isn't an awful lot to work with Matt. And then she's got another 12 with Capaldi, possibly plus one for the Christmas, making it 13. Do you know what we haven't had since Doctor Who came back? We haven't had a companion who leaves during the season.
No.
In the middle of the season.
I mean, not counting...
I'm not counting Adam.
Someone like Mickey.
Well, I'm not counting Mickey or Adam, because Mickey came back and went again and came back.
Yeah.
Obviously, Adam was only in for two episodes.
I mean, someone once said to me very recently, well, you know, in the end, she didn't have much character. And I can sort of see the argument there that, as I think we've said before, I don't think that Clara's character really was fantastically well formed, because she came in as more of a sort of an idea than a rigid character. But as I believe anyway, if you look back at the classic show.
Yeah.
You know, how many of those characters were well formed? In the end, the bottom line is the actress or the actor. I mean, even take Sarah Jane Smith, who is often counted as the most famous companion, the most popular. Her roots as the character within the classic show, where she was a journalist, and that sort of disappeared fairly quickly. There was nothing else to her. You never saw her background. You never met any family. You never really saw anything beyond her role as a companion. But Sladen gave it what was needed. And
yeah, absolutely.
I felt that with Jenna, is that she didn't have much to work with, but what she did horrendously well. And having just watched Time of the Doctor, which was again playing on iPlayer, I found watching the end scene with Smith, he was absolutely fantastic in his end scene. Even though, as I say, it might have been a little wordy, he plays it so beautifully. It's still underpinned by her reaction to him leaving. Mm. It creates the drama. So I think it's so, if you get the right actress there, I think you're a fool if you lose them for the wrong reason. But
yeah. Well, we've got a new companion coming in episode 2, Into the Dalek. That's when we first meet Danny Pink, apparently, played by Samuel Anderson. We don't really know much about him, although there's obviously been rumours about his character possibly having links to darkness and evil, and even perhaps the Master. I think earlier this year, when we were discussing whether or not the Master, what we felt about the speculation about the Master possibly returning in Series 8, there was a suggestion that Danny was the Master, but I don't think that's going to be the case. Do you?
No. I mean, I think, interestingly enough, there's been a... I mean, who knows? I mean, this is a bit of a far-fetched, because, you know, productions are so tight and locked, it's hard to manipulate, but I heard there's been a lot of rewrites as they've been going along. Mm. I doubt there would be such rewrites that they would have changed the entire storyline like that, but you never know. I mean, I got there was quite a severe load of rewrites going on in there, so maybe what was planned has changed, in the same way that, you know, what was planned with Eccleston was changed to her, and that's... was quite an amazing change from the earlier ideas, if you just think of it as a concept.
Mm.
So,
yeah.
Who knows?
Who knows, indeed. That's what it's all about. Quick shout out for Space Elevator, who we're going to be featuring on Casterbus later this week. That's our Doctor Who style group with a lady called the Duchess who sings, which we featured a little bit on a few weeks back.
Yeah.
So that they're going to be featuring on Casterbus later this week, possibly around the time that we see this podcast going live. And let us move on then to the next topic on today's Casterbus podcast with the K, which is the Deep Breath BBC Radio trailers. Have you heard any of these?
I saw the article. I've not actually listened to
them. Okay. Well, they're kind of cool and creepy. Hearing Doctor Who that's meant for TV on the radio is quite odd. As anyone who's listened to the old, the soundtracks.
Genesis, the Daleks, and...
Well, no, I was thinking of the soundtracks for the missing episodes.
Oh, right, okay.
Specifically. Anyone who's into Tales from Another, yeah. It's quite unusual. It can be slightly jarring. On Six Music last week, there was a couple of trailers. Here's one of them. Doctor says, "I never know where the faces come from. They just pop up." Clara says, "I don't think I know who the Doctor is anymore." And, you know, you've heard these from the trailer on TV. And then there's this one from the Doctor. It's covered in lines, but I didn't do the frowning. Who frowned me this face? Which is an interesting, tantalising glimpse into whether or not we'll get an explanation for why he looks like who he looks like. Not that any of us here, I think, really cares why he looks like who he looks like. Let's not get too much into that. There was another one, though, which I felt was so good I even tweeted about it. Just heard the trailer on Six Music. Clara, am I a good man? Says the Doctor. I don't know, says Clara. Neither do I. Which I think is a very good trailer. Just a quick 20-seconder. I mean, that's very good. I have a feeling that I'm getting from this series, as we've said before, but in terms of the promotion, although I haven't seen any posters anywhere, and I'm not saying that there are no posters, I am feeling that this is the best promoted series of Doctor Who since 2005.
Do you want to extrapolate more from that?
Yeah. Well, back in 2005, we had those special scenes that were very kind of contemporary. So you have the Doctor and Rose in the TARDIS looking at the camera and talking, breaking the fourth wall. Rose saying that she has a choice and all that bobbins. Then you've got the Doctor in that special flame fireball scene, which just didn't happen in the series, even though everyone was waiting to see it. But you had posters on bus stands. You had big ad hoarding posters. You had little ident posters, things on the TV. And you had radio trailers. Now, I know we've had radio trailers before. I don't know if there's any actual posters out there. But I just feel that there's a little bit more of a cohesiveness to how this series of Doctor Who is being promoted. And certainly in terms of BBC Press Office and BBC Pictures as well, from a website management point of view, it is extremely easy to get hold of material this time.
Absolutely. You can download it all from Pirate Bay. Incredible, BBC. That is a real way to go in promoting your show. Just release them all out beforehand.
But that aside, what do you guys feel?
You know, for me, it's a bit different. I mean, I don't know what it's like over there, obviously. I can only speak for what it's like over here. And for series one, it was practically non-existent.
Yeah.
Especially since it had aired a little bit on PBS here. And then finally, I think like we got, what, a year after you guys originally. And then that was on the Sci-Fi channel, where they really didn't quite treat it accordingly. And then for the David Tennant era, you know, people started to gain more attention and more notice of it. But it wasn't until Matt Smith came in with series five that all of a sudden BBC America had billboards and posters and advertisements galore and in magazines all over the place. And not entirely sure why that change when he came on was there. But now with Peter Capaldi, I mean, there's the world tour, which obviously everybody is, all those announced cities are getting. And then a magazine, like certainly Entertainment Weekly, had a cover and an article. But I'm not seeing much else. I'm not really seeing like all the big billboards. I'm not really seeing all the big to do that they did when Matt Smith had the role in series five.
Okay. James?
Yeah, I think I probably agree with you. I think it has been quite cohesive. Our problem is, as it comes this sort of time, I try and batten down the hatches a little bit and try and avoid too much of the material. But I think they've done quite a good job, which isn't surprising really after so many years, sort of years or so, they're going to be more streamlined.
Now, have either of you guys seen the cinema, the theatrical, the YouTube capture of the theatrical screening from one of the premieres of Deep Breath of the new opening titles?
Yes.
No.
No, you have, Brian.
I have, yeah.
And you've seen the original that they're based on, haven't you?
Yes.
So how do you feel about them?
Well, we did a podcast a while ago when that original fan-made one was going around. Yeah. And the way I recall it, both James and I, not to speak for James, but the way I remember it was we both were impressed by the work that was put into it, but not the theme itself, you know, mm-hmm. not the clock.
That's how I recall
it,
too.
And all that other things. And so seeing that it actually made it as the actual, first of all, seeing that it actually made it, I'm going to go ahead and bring up Time Leech again and just say, where's our credit? But,
Yeah.
you know, whatever. Secondly, Moffat seems to like to borrow from fans, and it's cool. I think it's very impressive that that person who did that title got it used in the show. But, you know, we went through, I think, two or three different ones, and I just remember that one. I was very impressed by the skill, by the craftsmanship of the designer, but not the clocks, not the cogs. You know, it didn't wow me. So, you know, it's the new title sequence. I'm curious more so to hear the song properly. I think that's the one thing the video kind of obviously distorted the audio a bit. So I'm curious to see how that sounds. But visually, you know, once again, it's nice. It's just I wouldn't say it's the best one out there.
I mean, we talked about them previously, didn't we? This guy who's created these titles with all the swirly clocks and cogs and TARDIS and things, and it looked very stunning. But does it suit Doctor Who, or is it all a bit? Look, this is a show about time travel.
Yeah.
Well, that was my original objection to it. Sorry, James. But that was my original objection to it. It was like the show. Clearly, it's about time travel, so let's show a watch and watch cogs and, you know, watch face. And it's not really something that it ever did before. You know, I always liked more that kind of vortex or space kind of thing, because it kind of, to me, said a little bit more about the show than that. I don't know. When I saw it, like I said, it was beautiful work by the creator, but it just wasn't show material for me. And then here, you know, I'll probably take flack for saying this, but I really think Moff doesn't have taste. I think he's one of those guys that unless somebody else dresses him, you know, he would probably be the most gaudy man in the world. So I think that probably a lot into seriously, you know, I think that goes a lot into what he's done with his era. I mean, look at the Matt Smith console room from series 5. That thing was atrocious to look at. His new one's beautiful, but the one from Series 5, it was so hard to look at because there were so many similar colors. The thing just kind of blended together. It was very difficult. It was very too much, you know. But, you know, he's in charge. He's going to choose what he chooses. What can we do?
None of his have been particularly good. I didn't like the original one. I thought the explosions and the sound effects that was going down the time tunnel were a little crass. And I don't know. It just all felt a bit.
I didn't mind them so much. I do like the second one, though. I really like
Well, it.
I agree with that one.
I just can't stand the doors at the end of it, though.
Yes, I know.
Ruined. Absolutely agree with that.
I think the rest of it sits together really, really well. And yes, I'm a little bit upset that they've got rid of it, to be honest with you. Because it only had 6 episodes, didn't it? Or 7 episodes.
Yeah.
And it didn't appear in the 50th anniversary, either.
No, it didn't.
It would have been like putting Peter Davison's face in place of Tom Baker's face for the 80s titles. You know, that would have been neat. Yeah. And this is the thing that for all the people out there that were complaining and upset that Peter Capaldi is using Matt Smith's sonic screwdriver, you know, he's the same character. They're his toys. They're his equipment. Like when because he changes his face doesn't mean he's going to change everything completely. And I feel that the show is the same way.
He's using the same TARDIS as well, the cheeky swine.
Right. Mm. You know, it's the titles. I don't feel that they need to be that different, especially if it was the title sequence for the past 3 years, I can understand wanting things to feel fresh. But like you said, it was used on 6 episodes. It would have been nice to just kind of use it because it was a very nice title sequence. Drop the doors, like James said, because I completely agree with that. And it's a really nice title sequence.
Well, they have dropped the doors.
Oh, yes, that would be nice. I think it's a funny thing, isn't it, that you there's this need for change, when in a sense, I think I quite liked in the old show the way that you would have Colin Baker get up in Davison's console room and start using that, and the same with McCoy and the same with Troughton to a degree. I know there's little minor differences there, but the bottom line is it sort of reinforces the fact this is the same person. This is his home.
Yeah,
he's just a different. And as soon as you suddenly comes back and the whole thing's being changed, or, you know, and I think that again goes back to why I think companions are quite important to carry on the transition period, because it does reinforce that this is the same person. So I agree. I think the intro as well has a bit to do with that too, but I don't like it too much on the button. I mean, I thought as everyone else, I thought it was a beautifully done sequence and the guy had a lot of 3D talent, but at the same time, to me, it was exactly the sort of thing that you don't do for television, unfortunately, because it was too on the button. You know, it's about time travel. It's just like someone who's gone around an advertiser, you know, a board meeting with advertisers, and they've gone, well, it's about time, so we've got to have clocks, so we'll have cogs. He's a time lord, so we've got to have the seal of Rassilon on there on a pocket watch. And, you know, it's just a bit, you know, TV should be, you know, there should be a certain amount of subtlety there. I used to like the old title sequences from the old TV show, especially in the 80s, which really had sod all to do with the show because it was space, which, you know, that was it, wasn't it? It wasn't even a time tunnel, really. And, you know, why should it have to be so blatant?
Yeah, I will say, I've just found it. I'll go ahead and pass it on to you real quick. But I will say that I like the end of it. What they've done to it at the end is different. They did remove that seal of Rassilon. You know, thing which rightly so that shouldn't have been
well,
there.
Well, probably
the
so.
End,
he yeah, sends
the
it
end of its
pay.
Regular time vortex tunnel. I like the effect on it. It's very nice. It's the beginning. That's just kind of like, yeah, it's about time travel. Here's your clock. Like a million other time travel shows haven't done that before. I mean, good.
Lose
good
the
them.
Clocks and
them
keep
the
blue
credit.
Wispy stuff. I say.
Well, this is something we said, isn't it? We like the effect on the original guys. You know, of the spinniness and the sort of texture sort of element of the forms. But it was the fact they were cogs and the fact it was clocks. It was like, no, that's just too, I don't know. It's to say, yeah, it just lacks any sort of subtlety. I mean, I would say perhaps, I wouldn't say that Moffat lacks taste. I wouldn't be able to say there, but I would say there's a certain lack
Ryan's
of subtlety.
Ryan's already said it. There's nothing wrong with it. He's done it. He's broken that wall.
I would say there seems to be a lack of subtlety. You get rid of those terrible doors and you end up putting in a load of cogs and you think, no, that's too fanboy for me. I think it's too obvious. It lacks that professional finish, but it looks good. I'll give him that. Yeah. Oh.
Oh well, let's move on to the recommendation. Oh, I suspect we won't be recommending the new Doctor Who opening title. But there are other things we might recommend this week. Brian, do you want to go first? Can I just say, as I spoke to you then, I pointed at the microphone as if you were the microphone.
I am the microphone.
Do you want to go first?
That is my new regenerative form. I never know where the bodies come from.
That's what he
says. recommendations.
We're doing James Butler, the bodies, I think.
You know, I don't have anything super spectacular to recommend. However, I have been going back through some history of Doctor Who, and I decided I wanted to watch all of the anniversary specials. I'm not watching them in order
for
some reason.
Did you watch Dimensions in Time yet?
You know, I didn't watch Dimensions in Time, but I did watch the bloopers that are on YouTube from it.
Okay, right.
So I did, and honestly, it was kind of one of the things that made me start doing this, because I watched, I was watching, what was it? I can't remember. Oh, it might have been the Two Doctors, and it got me interested in doing the anniversary specials. But then I watched that, and I was like, yeah, I'm going to do this. I actually just watched Silver Nemesis, which I enjoy, aside from the cyber being a little too emotional. It's a good story. But yeah, I went out, and I went through my whole collection, and I pulled out all the anniversary stories and just felt that might be a fun kind of thing to celebrate Doctor Who, just watch all the times they celebrated Doctor Who. So,
did you watch Time of the Rani?
It's not an anniversary one, is it?
No,
but it is special. It is a very special episode.
Yeah. No, I haven't done that.
So which would you recommend out of the specials that you've been watching?
Which do I think are the best? Or
Which would you recommend? If we had to say, Brian Terranova, you bastard, which one would you recommend?
Well, honestly, I think out of all the TV specials, the three that kind of stick the most in my mind are the Three Doctors, the Five Doctors, and now Day of the Doctor, because I thought they were all really very good.
Politician, pick one.
No, I can't pick one. It's too damn hard. maybe the Five Doctors, probably because I have the most emotional attachment to it, the most memory connected with it.
It's a good one. And you've got the regeneration cycle in there, so you've got a link to the new series with the Master offering offering the...
being offered the new regenerative cycle.
Yes, exactly.
That's what you're trying to say. Okay.
I was trying very hard.
James, what's your recommendation this week?
I recommend that you don't watch the new the new intro when it comes up, close your eyes and go into a corner and cry. No, it's not that bad. And bless the fan who inspired it. Good stuff, probably. What would I recommend? Yeah, well, I would recommend, obviously, what if you're in the UK and you've got iPlayer, I would certainly recommend that you watch Time of the Doctor, which is still running this week, just to sort of get into the mood for the new story. As I say, I watched it again, and this time I was really touched by Matt Smith all the way through. I just thought, God, you know, it's just a reminder of how much he nailed that character, especially the comedy moments. You know, that lovely moment where, you know, he's lost his hair, and she says, "Put his hair, put your hair back on, because you've got ears like rocket fins," and he's just so pleased about it. Is he? I know, and it's just such a wonderful performance.
I thought you were recommending it for those, you know, getting ready for the new series, because, you know, probably going out to those. If you're not sure you're excited for Series 8 yet, watch Time of the Doctor, and then you most certainly will be excited for Series 8 coming along. Because I know that's what I would watch Time of the Doctor for.
Well, I mean, it's the old things we've said before. Once you've watched something a few times, you've limited your expectations because you know what's going to happen. So you kind of are better able to actually enjoy what's there. And in the end, we all just want to enjoy what's there, whether it be Time of the Doctor, Time of the Rani, Timer and the Rani, or Timer and the Rani. You desperately want to try and enjoy it.
Or Trial of the Time Lord.
Anything with a T, it probably requires a little helping hand of exposure. But yeah, no, I really enjoy his performance. As I say, I think the story's a little twee. I think the aging of him, to me, doesn't work very well. I still really think it's one of those moments like Evolution of the Daleks. The Daleks always suffer from, the Doctor is regenerating. Why the hell not one of those 50 Daleks just didn't shoot him while he was dancing around, shouting and waving his arms before doing anything on the roof and regenerating? Yeah. You know, you had ages to do it. As a narrative dramatic moment, you have to suspend disbelief and go, yeah, this is just so we can see the build up to this big moment. But really, you do feel like, if you're a Dalek, you think, oh, come on, for God's sake, just give me a chance here. He's right there. He's pirouetting around. He's not doing anything. I've got a bloody gun. It's the only thing I have got. I haven't got anything else I can do right now. I mean, it's not like I could be distracted and decided to go and build a snowman here or go and buy something.
I know how it went. Okay, so you got the Dalek sniper on the hill, obviously, goes, I have a clear shot. And then up there, you've got the Emperor Dalek Davros going, no, the Doctor might do something. It's a trap. Don't do anything yet. No, shoot him. No, wait. He's dancing. It's a trap. No, wait. That's
so you're really feeding into that line, which is becoming a little old, the Doctor is so clever. Yeah, I think exactly. I think that may be the other thing which gets me a bit about the story is again, I'm someone who quite likes the God aspect of the Doctor. I like the idea in the sense that he is so powerful. And it's because he is, because he's done so much. He isn't like a human. There is something to fear about him. But when it gets to that point, like in the Big Bang, or in this, to the point where there's such fear, he sort of almost becomes a superhero. You lose that sense of believability almost, because he is a fallible character. And suddenly it's like, yeah, well, he's still got nothing.
That is why I much prefer the God complex to something like the Big Bang.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I think you need, it's good to have him having that power, but you've got to have some sort of, but anyway, I think Time of the Rani is a good build up, because it's lovely to see Matt Smith really shine in that last performance. I say, Jenna, the crush Coleman is great in it. And yeah, there's some nice moments. Hats off to Moffat. I think Handles is lovely to watch.
You got to be careful what you're recommending there, because plenty of people are going to tune in to Time of the Rani and be expecting the Matt Smith tale.
Yes, Time of the Doctor. Sorry, Time of the Rani. Yes. Oh. Yeah. So yeah, I'd recommend that. Oh, and one final one is that they're still running on Kindle those Doctor Who novels at 99p, like the one that Neil Gaiman did.
All right.
They're running at 99p at the moment. So if you want a quick read of some of the new material throughout the Doctor's life, that's quite a good bargain.
That is a bargain. Okay, my recommendation this week is the rather massive Classic Doctor Who DVD compendium, which covers every disc, every episode, and every extra. And it's a weighty tome. Where is it? Hello? I'll give you an idea of how much it weighs. There we go. There you go. That's how much it weighs. It's a big book, and it is available in ebook and in print format, £14.90 for print or ebook £9.60.
Funnily enough, that sound is the exact same sound that you get if you actually took Time of the Rani's plot and dropped it somewhere, you get that same thudding, thumping,
No. Time of the Rani's plot is more like this.
I knew you were going to go down this route.
Hang on. There you go. Whereas
that
one was more like this.
Yeah.
That's one for the Fry and Laurie fans.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. So that is my recommendation this week. It's a chock-a-block full of stuff. There's five appendices covering supplementary releases of Classic Who episodes and related programs. There's a list of the hidden Easter eggs, details of DVD releases in other countries and everything. It's an amazing piece of work by Paul Smith, and I hope it sells extremely well. It's published by Wonderful Books, and appropriately so, I think. We're drawing to a close for this week's podcast. And next week, we are live on Google Hangouts and YouTube. We're not in the same place. We'll still be doing it like this, but we'll be using Hangouts, and we'll be doing it at 3 p.m. UK time, which is, Brian?
That is 10 a.m. US time.
Is that Eastern time?
Yes, Eastern time.
10 a.m. Eastern time. Yep. So we will be letting you know on YouTube and Facebook when we're about to begin. You are more than welcome to join us. We will give you the link to give us your comments and thoughts. And naturally, we will be talking about Deep Breath, which aired the evening before, which is why we're doing a live episode. So that's that. Until next time, goodbye.